Jacob and Esau in the womb. And we get this verse, Genesis 25:23. And the Lord answered her, this is Rebecca, two nations are in your womb. Two separate peoples shall issue from your body. One people shall be mightier than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So lots of interesting commentary on this verse, but I'm just going to pull one short, simple one, which is on these last couple words that I bolded, right? And the older shall serve the younger. So that's the literal translation, but the Hebrew is slightly different. It says, the Rav Ya'avod Tse'ir. So Tse'ir is younger, but Rav can mean a lot of different things. Rav usually means greater or the master of. So it's not, it's interesting that the pair is not entirely about age, right? The Rav and the greater shall serve the younger. So that's going to be, as our Hasidim like to do, a moral principle that we can bring in. So Rabbi Avram Yaakov Friedman of Sadigura, who we've never learned before, who happens to be the son of the Rizhner Rebbe. So the Rizhner Hasidim are still around today, prominent in Israel. And he was the second son of the Rizhner Rebbe. They had to flee to Sadigura in order to escape the Tsar at the in the 1800s. And then the dynasty was reestablished later in his life back in the hometown of Ruzhin. But some of the family stayed behind in Sadigura. All of this is in the Ukraine today. The verse was explained by Rabbi Avram Yaakov Friedman of Sadigura. And the greater shall serve the lesser, or the younger. To the greatest possible extent, a person needs to work on themselves until one makes themselves small and has achieved the trait of humility. So this is a pun, sort of, or a move that Avram Yaakov is making because of the Hebrew. The word is v'rav ya'avod tse'ir. The greater shall serve the younger is how I translate it. But ya'avod is from the Hebrew root of oved, meaning to work or to serve. So the word work can be kind of, at least the way the Sadigura Rabbi is teaching it, can be reflexive, right? The greater shall serve the younger, or the lesser, is being used here as you shall take your greater characteristics and use them to work on your lesser characteristics. Or you shall, another way to say this is, you shall take your greatness and make it serve your lesserness. Otherwise saying, you got to work on yourself and take all that is great about you and make it humble, right? Like, refract your greatness, work it into being something kind of humble. This is a very Hasidic Musar kind of teaching about the importance of humility and how valuable it very is. And the last thing I'll just say is it's a very Hasidic thing to be process oriented as opposed to goal oriented, right? And we've talked about this many, many times, that the person who is trying to achieve nirvana, right? The person who's trying to get to a destination, like there's a goal and they say, once I get to the goal, I'm done working on myself. Nope. It's a lifelong practice. The Hebrew here specifically reflects that idea, that he says, yaktin et atzmo vayizka lemidat anava, that you should be zoche the mida of anava, to speak in the language of a Hasidic rabbi, right? You should merit to achieve the trait of humility, right? Like, you've got to work towards the point of beginning to master this trait, right? It's a practice, a spiritual discipline that you engage in. All right, that's that text. We'll keep going. We'll do the next text, which is kind of reflecting this issue of karma that we talked about before. Vayazed Yaakov nazid vayavo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayef. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esav came in from the open, famished. Okay? And then a couple verses later, so that's verse 29. We skip a few verses and we get five verses later, verse 34. V'Yaakov natan le'Esav lechem unazid adashim v'yachal v'yishte v'yakom v'yelech v'yivez Esav et ha-bechora. Jacob then gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and drank, and he rose and went away. Thus did Esau spurn the birthright. So this is the early story, right? There's two stories of deception. The first one is the birthright. The second one is the blessing. We're going to skip the blessing story. It's not going to come up. Something that I never noticed before. At the beginning, in verse 29, we're told Jacob was cooking a stew. Although if I were to translate it literally, it says, Vayazed Yaakov Nazid. A better translation was, once when he was stewing a stew, right? Since the verb and the noun are used the same Hebrew root of Yazed and Nazid. Also notable, at least from my perspective, I've never seen that word before. Nazid is not a common word. Maybe for modern Israelis, they know of it, but I'd never seen it. But for me, the interesting thing about that verse that I'd never noticed before is I always knew that it was lentil stew. I never noticed that the first time it's mentioned, lentils are not mentioned. So you have to go five lines later to learn that it's lentil stew, which is interesting. I don't know if there's anything to it. Iggy, do you have a question?
Why is it lentil stew in the first place?
That's a great question, and our Hasidic rabbi has an answer for you. He is not a plant. He did not know that that was the answer. It is a good question. The question that Iggy is asking is a question that any kind of rabbi of the medieval period would kind of ask, which is to say it in a more succinct way, which you have all learned through this class. Why are we being given an unnecessary detail which might be neat in the story, but doesn't seem to have any specific need, right? We don't necessarily need this detail that the stew was made of lentils, right? How often do we get a recipe in the Torah? In fact, the last time we got a recipe was a really weird one, which is that Abraham, when he is feeding the three visitors to his tent, we are told that he feeds them lamb, and he feeds them milk, to which all of our rabbis immediately go, Abraham, you're not supposed to serve milk with meat. And then all the rabbis get into it as a kind of a discussion as to whether this is permitted or forbidden. And then one of the interesting notes that they make in that story is the question as to whether Abraham could have been violating the laws of Kashrut, considering the laws of Kashrut would not be given until Exodus 20, right, at Mount Sinai, right? Was Abraham chayev, was he obligated to keep kosher? Most of the rabbis say he did, but some of the medieval rabbis say he didn't, which I think is great, right? The idea that before Moses gets the Torah, Abraham was totally allowed to eat whatever he wanted, I love that, right? But, you know, that's neither here nor there. By the way, in the modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox world, if you were to repeat what I just said, you would get into a heated and violent debate. People would be really, really upset. For me, I would pull one of these books behind me off the shelf and say, Ibn Ezra says it right here, okay? Ibn Ezra, in this book that you also own in your Beit Midrash. But anyways, okay, so we're going to look at this text. We're going to look at a guy that we don't often see. He's a Spanish medieval rabbi who wrote a five-volume commentary on the Chumash, whose name is Rabbeinu Bachya. Okay, so notice, said Rabbeinu Bachya, Spain, who died in 1340, for what Esav desired to buy, Yaakov desired to sell. He was pursuing his appetite and was asking for the pleasures of this world, and he was paid with lentil stew. When all is right with the world, it is peaceful and glorious. It is like a circle, as a lentil is like a wheel. Everything that comes is replaced. Hakol ba vecholef. Therefore, it was the desire of Yaakov to sell it thusly, to exchange the life temporal for the life eternal. This is the service of God, which acts to conduct the path of the young person. Okay, so what's going on here? So first of all, Iggy asked the question, why lentils? The answer that Rabbeinu Bachya is giving is lentils are round. And in our story, there's a what comes around, goes around aspect of the story. And this is actually answering a statement that Tanya made before when we were discussing this whole notion. So she bristled, Tanya bristled at the idea that Jacob deceived Esav. And Tanya is in agreement with a rabbi who lived 700 years before us, which is Rabbeinu Bachya, which is to say that Jacob did not deceive Esav. What Jacob had to sell, Esau wanted to buy, right? So there's a what comes around goes around aspect to the story. There's a symbiosis, circle of life, everything is in balance aspect to things here, right? Esav didn't really, he had a birthright, didn't really want it. He really wanted, the food. And he really, it was the thing that he desired. And Yaakov didn't really, he made the food, but apparently he wasn't really holding on to it with, you know, deep desire. He was very willing to part with it in exchange for what Esau had. I remember in a class that I took in my fifth year of rabbinical school, Rabbi Richard Kamras, who used to be the rabbi in Baltimore and then moved to the West Coast and is a rabbi at a congregation in the Valley in Los Angeles, he was talking about the rabbi's role in fundraising, right? We were all, I think it's fifth years, when you're in your last year as a rabbinical student, I think one of the scariest things that I was ever told that I would need to do is ask people for money, right? Like I was like, oh my God, no, I don't want to do that. And Rabbi Kamras framed it in a beautiful way that has stuck with me ever since. By the way, the number of things that stick with you from a congregational rabbi in your fifth year of rabbinical school is very few, right? Like the advice you get from your colleagues, a lot of it is worth what you pay for it. And I don't mean the student loans I took out for my fifth year of rabbinical school. So Rabbi Kamras said, you know, you can't think of it as asking for money. You have to think of it as you have an idea, you have a vision, you have a project, which is really, really important. And you have a person in front of you who has the ability to support that worthwhile and important project. And the project won't happen if they don't give the money. So you're just connecting your values and their values together. As an idea, as a thing going forward, right? You say, this is a thing that we really should do, and you can do it, right? You're connecting this person's values with the thing that you want to do, which is a beautiful way of framing it. That is what's going on with Jacob and Esau, right? It's not deception. It's just what a good salesman does, which is you connect a product with a person who desires the product, and the exchange of the item for the product is valuable and is fair and is right, right? So it's really interesting. Hang on one sec, Iggy. Let me finish this one thought and then you can ask your question. So this is this little idea of kind of like everything is on balance because the sale is fair kind of plays into this broader idea that Rabbeinu Bachya is going to throw in, which is it's a circle symbol. It all works out in the wash. It's all fair. And that circle is that Yaakov and Esav are kind of paradigmatically separate, different people who are operating on different wavelengths, right? Esav is willing to sacrifice something that is valuable in the world to come in exchange for something in the world today. Whereas Yaakov is a dude who thinks he's, you know, of the world to come versus the here and now. That's what that phrase down here is. To exchange the life temporal for the life eternal. He uses the Hebrew here specifically, lahachlif et chaye sha'a b'chaye olam, which is a direct reference, I know buddy, which is a direct reference to a line in the Talmud. There's a story in the Talmud of Shimon bar Yochai, who comes out of a cave with his son and sees people harvesting grain. And they get upset because they've been busy in the cave learning Torah for 13 years. And here these people are not learning Torah. They're working in a field. And he gets upset. And he says, you exchange the life temporal for the life eternal. You are machlif chaye sha'a for chaye olam. At which point a voice comes down from the heavens and says, you guys are jerks. Go back in the cave. Because God is not happy with this kind of judgmental sensibility that Shimon bar Yochai has. that the life eternal is better than the life temporal. But here, Rabbeinu Bachya is kind of laying it out in not necessarily equal terms. And I say that because generally our rabbis do not regard Esav and Yaakov as equals. Generally, the rabbis think that Yaakov is better than Esav. Although I think in this text, you could argue, because of the concept of it being a circle and everything going around and coming around and all things being on balance, that perhaps it is, right? Where there is the life temporal and the life external, this world and the next world, and you need to balance them both. And there needs to be kind of a direct reflection. This last line I'll say, and then Iggy's going to ask his question, and then anybody else can ask a question, which is this last kind of kicker line that Bachya throws in there. He avodat Hashem shenoheget babachurot. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but it seems to say, or I translate it as, this is the service of God, which acts to conduct the path of the young person, which is, I think what this is saying is, balance in all things, my young Padawan, right? Like, it's very important for a person to understand that the service of God is hermetic and organic, right? There's this world and the world to come. There's things we buy and there's things we sell. There's things we need for now and there's things we need for later, right? Karmically, it kind of will all come out in the wash. It will all work out. So we're looking at this kind of like in a, the universe is on balance. The next text will deal with the concept of balance and punishment. All right, Iggy, go ahead, ask your question.
This one's going to be, this thing's going, I still don't, it still doesn't answer my question. Why lentil stew?
Lentil.
It could have been any stew with a circle.
Right. That's an interesting point. I didn't think of it that way. Why a lentil stew and not something else? I don't know. But lentils are the only food I know of that are round that you could cook in a stew. Can you think
cut
of
cut carrots.
Iggy thinks cut carrots would have worked there. I'm wondering in my head if carrots appear in the Bible. I don't know of carrots appearing in the Bible, which might imply that they didn't know about carrots 3,000 years ago.
They should have known about some other.
They should have known potatoes? About carrots. Potatoes. I think potatoes are a New World food. I don't think they existed in Asia at all. Asia and the Middle East at all. I could be wrong. Marilyn's nodding. Yeah. I could be. No? There were potatoes? No, there were not potatoes. I don't think there were potatoes. No. But it's a good question. I think you're right, though, on some level. There must have been a round food.
Tomatoes?
Tomatoes are a New World food.
But tomatoes were a diddle.
Peas! Peas are circular. Peas would have worked.
Yes.
No, tomatoes were imported back to Italy. They didn't. Oh. Yeah, crazy. All right. Great question, Iggy. Okay. Let's move on to the next. I didn't give you guys a chance to kind of reflect. Do you think this, how does this text strike you guys? The kind of everything on balance, things, it's all a circle, Simba. Like it, don't like it. Lentils. Audrey's nonplussed, unimpressed. Or she likes it, I don't know. Cool, all right, we'll do Nechama Leibovitz, and I'll give you the introduction to Nechama Leibovitz next. So hers is, like I said, it's hard. I think it was Renee who made the point that maybe only the women are smart enough to understand the women rabbinic commentators. I hold that that's entirely a possibility. I think I got Nechama here, but she's different than our other commentators. So Nechama is a 20th century commentator. Nechama Leibovitz lived from 1905 to 1997. She was born in Riga, Latvia. She came to Israel, I think, before the war. And then she was married to one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, a guy by the name of Yishayahu Leibowitz. And he was kind of prominent and famous as a philosopher and scholar and had many books published. And Nechama was brilliant in her own right and kind of kept a salon in her home where she would kind of type up her thoughts on the weekly Torah portion and invite people over to learn the weekly Torah portion. She started to do that in the, I think, mid-1940s. And then over time, by word of mouth, people started to gather in her apartment to the point at which the apartment was full. And starting in the 1970s, she started to occupy a room in the school. And then by the 1980s, she was teaching to an auditorium in Jerusalem. And for the last 15 years of her life, when she gave the weekly study on the Torah portion, she did it to an audience of like 500 people every single week. And her little, she called them giluim, little sheets. She kind of like just typed them up each week and whatever. And over time, some of her most foremost students said, you know, you have a book here. You should publish it. And she goes, oh, no, no, no. My husband does the book writing. These are just my thoughts on the Torah portion. And people said, yeah, they're really good. You should write a book. And so they took them and they glued them together and they came up with a 5-volume work, which is called what does she call it? Iyunim Chadashim B'Sefer Brishit, new studies on the Torah portion, which is to this day probably one of the best-selling books in the modern Orthodox community. Her students, I learned her commentary style from two of her students who were like first-generation students, one who's now a professor at JTS and one who's a professor at Schechter. So they would, you know, they could pepper their stories of, you know, they would teach it a little bit of like a text that we're about to do. And then they would tell me a story about, you know, going over to dinner at Nechama's house and, you know, the funny quirks that Nechama had. And, you know, those are kind of the cool things. So I'm like, you know, a generation beyond them. So anyways, that's Nechama Leibovitz, you know, to this day, one of the greatest scholars of Torah ever. Her methodology is very interesting. She would be referred to as a super commentator. She's not particularly interested in giving her own understanding of the Torah portion. Rather, she reads the medieval commentators and then gives her own thoughts about what ties those ideas together. So she kind of takes some of the drier literature of the time and starts to really peel apart, like, what are they trying to get at? Who are they? What's the main kind of moral principle that they're getting at? So fascinating. So she's going to also deal with this issue of what goes around comes around, but she's going to do it in a literary way. Another thing that she does, Marilyn, you would like this, I think, a lot. You would like her a lot specifically. Is she's really interested in literary analysis and comparative literature. So she's really particularly interested in like the specifics of why does this phrase appear here and where else do we see a phrase elsewhere in the Bible that looks like that and what does it mean? And she finds an unbelievable one here. So we're in Genesis 27:34. So we did the birthright story and we go on to the next story, which is the blessing story, right? You all remember Isaac's blind. Jacob wants to steal the blessing. He wears a furry coat over himself. He sends his brother out to go catch some wild game. The mother is really involved in the deception. You know, he has hair on his arms, fake hair on his arms. He cooks a meat stew for the father, right, in order to get the blessing. The deception works. There's this one hiccup point where the father says, where Isaac says, the voice is the voice, the touch is the touch of Esau, but the voice is the voice of Yaakov. So, and, you know, Yaakov kind of passes it off. And anyways, he deceives him. He gets the blessing. Blessing. He leaves. Esau comes in the next scene and says, Dad, I went hunting. I'm ready to make you a stew. And, you know, you'll give me the blessing. And Yitzchak, Isaac, says to him, What are you talking about? I already gave you the blessing. Are you forgetting? And the deception is revealed at that point. But too late. Oh, well. So at the result of all of that, Esau discovers that he has had his blessing as the firstborn son stolen. And his reply is this. Ki shomea Esau et divrei aviv, v'yitzak tzaka gedola umara, ad meod, v'yomer la'aviv, barcheni gam ani avi. When Esau heard his father's words, he burst into wild and bitter sobbing and said to his father, bless me too, father. Right? So a fascinating moment. And there's a little bit of repetition and unnecessary language here. So again, one of those, you know, hallmarks of things that we are interested in looking at in our Torah. So the words that are repetitive and the details that are unnecessary are the bolded ones on the screen. V'yitzak tz'aka gedola umara. So a yitzak is, I think of it as a scream, but here it's referred to as a sob. I think scream because the Hebrew word for cry is different, but, you know, direct translation is impossible since it's, you know, we're doing the best we can with what we think the words might approximate. But the verb and the noun are the same, right? V'yitzak tz'aka, right? He cries a cry would be a better way of saying it. Or he screams a scream. And that scream is gedola umara. It is big and it is great and it is bitter, right? Wild is the translation here, but, you know, we'll let the Jewish Publication Society do what the Jewish Publication Society wants to do. So at the top of the screen, you see Nechama says, Vayitzak tzaka gedola umara. So this is, those four words are the only words that she's interested in. She goes on. Another example of sin and punishment, she's picking up on a previous idea, is apparent from the middle of the verse via a guiding word, right? A mila draka, I think is what she said. After it is revealed to Esav what happened to him and what was done to him, it says, and he screamed a great and bitter scream. So Nechama is basically using a lot of fancy language for saying, we're really interested in this phrase, this bitter, great scream, but we're also interested in it in the concept of the karmic wheel that goes around, comes around, right? Why is there a sin? Or what is the sin, and when will there be punishment for it, right? Or another way of saying, like, how is this event echoed in other events that we see throughout the Torah? So Nechama continues. It is customary of our rabbis to explain different analogies between verses in order to teach the latent connection between sin and punishment. They equate our verse to what is said in the book of Esther. When Mordechai discovers the decree of Haman and Ahasuerus to destroy, to murder, and obliterate all the Jews, from old to young to old, babies and women, it says of Mordechai, and here's a quote, and he wore sackcloth and ashes, and he went about in the city and yelled a great and bitter yell. So if you notice that the language is just a little bit different, that's because it is a little bit different. In the Hebrew, our verse about Esav is Vayitzak tz'aka gedola umara. In the verse, we're down here now, in the verse on Mordechai, it says Vayizak za'aka gedola umara. So they're almost identical. They have one letter difference. One is Yitzak with a tzadi, and the other one is Yizak with a zayin. And they sound almost identical, and they mean almost the identical thing, which is fascinating. You don't often get that in Hebrew, where you get two words with three-letter roots, and the first letter is completely different, but they almost mean the exact same thing. And the translation that I came out with from looking in the Bible is a great and bitter yell. So yell versus scream. Okay. Is there a difference? Is there a distinction? I don't know. Okay. Regarding this similarity between the verses, our rabbis said in Breishit Rabbah, so a rabbinic commentary, all those that said that God is lenient or soft, his life will be softened, which Rashi comments as abandoned. Meaning, if a person thinks that God should go easy on sinners, or if a person is very laid back and thinks that God is laid back, God will actually come down on them very harshly, right? So rather, and Mechama continues, rather, God's anger is long and high. Okay. One scream was there from Yaakov to Esav, as it is written, and he screamed a great and bitter scream. And how is there payback for this? In Shushan, as it is taught, and he yelled a great and bitter yell. So Mechama is going to do this interesting thing. She's basically saying, and are based on the thing that the rabbis do, there's some sort of cosmic link between what happens with Mordechai and what happens with Esav. It's not a coincidence that the language and the scream and the injustice are repeated. On some level, it seems that what was done to Esav is unfair, and he screams out about it. And therefore, we have a repeat of that later on in the book of Esther. What is about to be done to the Jews is unfair, and Mordechai calls out about it. It's very interesting. But this is that spot where I'm not entirely sure where Nechama's going with it, because the nature of the karmic echo is a little confusing to me. I'm not totally clear on whether this is like what goes around comes around in a good sense, what goes around comes around in a bad sense, whether there's a sin by Esau and it's repaid to Mordechai, whether the sin is Jacob's sin and it's repaid to Mordechai, and whether the punishments are equal or whether just the reactions are equal, and so on. All right, it's not done there. Don't worry. Punishment does not come immediately. Rather, the deed of injustice that occurred remains, and this is very interesting language by her, hanging and stands in the space of the universe, v'chalalu shel olam. And when the time comes, God takes revenge indeed, which is some very scary language, right? But basically, like, when you put negative energy into the cosmos and you don't get payback immediately, it doesn't go away, right? When bad stuff happens, it doesn't just evaporate. Bad people, bad things get punished. They may just not happen in your lifetime. It may come a couple hundred years later, right? The bad stuff, the bad juju floats around in the universe and it comes down another time later, right? And the language here is very specific, that it's like very like, they're like, revenge indeed is the phrase that God uses here, that like God's memory is long and God will revisit it, at least is the implication here. The idea returns, in other words, in Rashi on the Psalms. So there's a psalm here that Rashi comments on, and Nechama found it and drew it into this conversation. So Nechama has now pulled three different texts from three different places in together to show that, like, there's kind of a karmic, cosmic balancing of the universe that God does. He continues, "You have fed them tears as their daily bread." This is from Psalms. "Made them drink great measures of tears." So the Hebrew here is he'echaltam lechem dim'a v'tashkemo b'dim'ot shalish. So the standard translation by the commentators is, and you know, you feed them tears as their daily bread, right? People will eat their words. Another way of saying this: people will get their punishment, and they'll be made to drink of their own tears, right? And the word for great measures of tears is dim'ot shalish. The Hebrew word shalish can be great, but it can also mean third. And so the rabbis, I know this is complicated. I told you she was a smart lady. So she keeps going. "These tears are a third. According to the simple meaning of the verse, we know only great tears. And the translators render tears in large measure. But Rashi brings from the rabbis, from an unknown source, these tears are a third. Three tears fell from Esav, as it teaches. And he screamed," that's one tier, "a great," that's the second tier, "and bitter," that's the third tier. So what she did there was she drew together these two texts and said, basically, he screamed a great and bitter scream is a reference directly to, you fed them tears as their daily bread and made them drink great measure of tears, meaning that what comes around goes around, right? That Esav is being somehow karmically punished for something that he did. And, you know, that's, I guess, the way he treats his brother, the way he kind of lords his power over his brother, or perhaps it's his future behavior. Or maybe it's just the kind of rabbinic idea that Esav in general is not a very good guy. Okay, we're going to finish this off with the last sentence. And then I'm going to kind of go out a little bit from Nechama, because as I mentioned, her words are kind of confusing. And I think to try and like pull out the exact meaning of what she is saying is not necessary to kind of understand it in a broader sense. So she finishes off by saying, "This teaches us that those that speak of our tears add them to his bottle, gathers also the tears of Esav the wicked, and are the defendants and plaintiffs of their judgment." So that's kind of the big finish, which is also fairly confusing, right? She's kind of saying this, that we collect all of our pain, all of the tears of Mordechai, the tears of Esav, maybe even the tears of Yaakov, and we put them together, and they all come together in a notion of creating a sense of judgment and justice, right? There is no separating the act from the punishment. There is no separating the judge from the judged. There is no separating the perpetrator and the victim, right? They're all kind of woven together in the grander sense and the grander scheme of things, right? The tears all go into the same bottle. And so our pain and the pain of others is drawn together. That may be what she was getting at. It may be me kind of riffing off of what she is getting at in a way that is spinning it homiletically, but pointing out that an individual who is wicked is not necessarily permanently wicked, but is rather guilty of their sin, and is their pain is then added to our pain and is felt by all, right? And we try and pull that apart and come to some sort of reckoning with it and understand it ultimately, right? Esav is a flawed individual who does a not good thing, but he is also wronged and his pain is real. Mordechai feels real pain at what is about to be kind of unleashed upon him. And God is kind of sitting in this whole kind of cosmic balance, trying to get the scales evened and right. Like wrongdoing will occur to one individual at one place, and at another point in time, it will come out for another person. You know, the big wheel keeps on turning, right? Sometimes it works out for your good, and sometimes it doesn't. I think that that's part of what is going on here. All right, I see that Marilyn is not buying what I'm selling. Go ahead.
Trying to formulate this, so I'm just going to say a couple of things and see where it goes. What is the purpose of punishment? And in a just society, is it revenge or is it educational? Should a person learn from his or her mistakes? You know, and that's not being specifically addressed here. You know, what is the purpose of this punishment? And if the punishment comes down later on somebody else, what is the purpose of that kind of karma? The second thing that is in my head is on a couple of levels. First of all, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Notice it doesn't say you can't have two eyes for an eye or a whole bunch of teeth for a tooth. There's a limit. No more than an eye for an eye. But yes, you can have justice that is equivocal. When you're punishing somebody in another generation, where's the equivalence? Okay? Just asking. I don't have answers. And then finally, I'm thinking about Exodus, which I understand hasn't happened yet, where Pharaoh is given 10 chances to learn his lesson. And again, to a certain degree, that suggests that justice must have this beneficial learn from component, you know, that there are limits on this kind of thing, which I'm not seeing here. And this explanation there, that the whole idea that karma is something that comes generations down the line is very troublesome to me, because the person who initiates the wrongness, the sin, the evil, really then is getting off scot-free, and there is no what goes around comes around that's so comforting to some people. And so I am struggling here, and I have no answer for you, and but it was very interesting reading her, because she's the one who got me thinking about all these questions that I think we need to answer. What is the purpose of punishment? Who should suffer for punishment? What is the benefit to us by the other person's punishment, what's the benefit to the other person of that punishment? These are questions that, if we're talking about justice, have to be answered.
I mean, I think, so to go back to the text, because it's really, it's still bothering me to kind of unravel what's the, why is there this karmic echo between these two stories? You know, the story of Mordechai's cry is really mysterious, because we all know how the story of Esther ends, right? Haman doesn't kill all the Jews. And so what is the purpose of Mordechai's cry? Possibly the cry is, so maybe what was going on here, I'm thinking aloud, unfortunately, is that Esav cries out to God, and God kind of goes, I can't help you, buddy. You're not going to get your birthright. You're not going to get your blessing. But when Mordechai calls out to God, God does hear him, because ultimately it will be Haman who gets killed, and Haman will be punished. So that, you know, the fact that justice was not done for Esav, maybe somewhere, you know, God is like, I'm not going to hook you up, but somewhere down the road, your pain, I will hear it again, and I will help that person out. It doesn't solve Marilyn's problem, which is that hundreds of years down the line, it doesn't do any of us any good. But this notion...
There's a problem of bringing in other texts that seem to contradict this concept of karma, that there are multiple, and again, I understand who actually wrote the Torah, but there seem to be these contradictory approaches that either support or avoid a construct of just. What is just? What is justice? That I think is at the core of any established organizational structure. It is either just or unjust, and if it's unjust, we reject it, and if it's just, we learn to live with it and accept it, because it is just for everyone. And so I don't see, I'm having a problem, I think, a little bit with I'm having a big problem with this.
I hear you. I don't have a great answer for you, because I think you're right to say that this is a troubling text and it's difficult. Nechama, this is a weird one to start off your learning about Nechama Leibovitz with, because I've learned Nechama before, and Nechama, she has some wonderful teachings, specifically, maybe we'll do them when we get to it. She does some really amazing things with Pharaoh's hardening of his heart. She does a big paragraph. I taught it to my advanced 9th and 10th grade class a couple years ago in Denver. We just spent weeks and weeks and weeks pulling apart the hardening of the heart and all of the meanings of the concept. She's very philosophical about the notions of fate and fatalism and punishment and sin. Clearly this one page thing is not the totality of her 5-book series, right? But another thing that I'm thinking about is this notion that shows up in our texts regarding that we don't see the work, we don't necessarily see the results of our work in our lifetimes, right? And I'm thinking today, especially following this election, of the stories that you hear of disenfranchised African Americans in the Deep South after the war during Jim Crow, where, you know, black sharecroppers were turned away from the polls and were not permitted to vote, and did not experience fairness or justice in their lifetimes. You know, people who were literally slaves in their own lifetimes, 3 and 4 generations later, their great-grandchildren not only were becoming voters, but also were able to become politicians and were able to vote at the polls and were able to swing an election, which ultimately resulted in our first African-American female vice president, right? So we don't see the results of the work of our labor in our own lifetimes. We work for the future. So there's a karmic aspect to that. I know that I'm spinning Nechama in a funny way, because she's mostly talking about kind of echoes of punishment and retribution, but I think the both of them kind of work out, because, like I mentioned, Haman is ultimately the one who gets paid back with the crying out of a great cry. All right, Tanya has her hand up. She's had it up for a while. Go ahead, Tanya.
Okay, I want to say two things, you know, in relation to what you just said. I think that's why we have to redig the wells, like Isaac. You know, Isaac went through and had to redig Abraham's wells. And, you know, not everybody is going to be a Cesar Chavez, a Martin Luther King, or, you know, some great pioneer, or everybody's not going to be an Abraham. And I believe one of the key ideas in that, for each generation, we're going to have somebody redig those wells and make sure that those ideas and those teachings don't die from great people like that. And then the other thing that I thought about when we were talking about this whole karma, not karma, do you remember when David was king, and this is later on in the Tanakh, there was a famine in the land. And David did some research, and then he found out that King Saul had violated a treaty with the Gibeonites. And so what he did was he asked for 7 of Saul's sons, and he had to hang those guys in order to stop this famine. And that's one of the things that bothered me, because remember, you know, the Gibeonites had dressed up like they were really poor and had come from a long way. And actually, the Israelites didn't wipe them out. They made them to be the carriers of water and the choppers of wood, and they made a treaty or a covenant with them. Well, Saul obviously violated and killed some of them, so it created a really big problem.
Yeah, I mean, you brought in a fourth story, which I think opens our eyes a little bit to this idea of, like, revisiting, you know, punishment and reward down the road and whether it's fair or not. I think it's a really good story. I think, you know, to Marilyn's point, I don't know how I feel about it. And I think that's okay. I mean, I think one of the things that looking at rabbinic commentators very carefully does is it forces us to ask hard questions about whether we think the nature of the universe is right and just and fair. And it's okay to end up with the notion that, you know, we feel a little awkward about punishing the Gibeonites for, you know, the works of their ancestors, that they need to be, you know, whether we feel okay about that or not. Like, but, you know, I think I don't really have a good, you know, big finish for this, other than to say, understanding that some of the bad things that happened in the past will ultimately be kind of finished off. The big wheel keeps turning, but also the good things will kind of come back, is a blessing that I can bless all of us with as we go forward. It may not be a thing that we can say practically, absolutely, totally happens. It's a thing that we can say we hope happens and we pray for. And it's the best we can do. All right, that's my class for this week. Oh, Phil's got a question into bonus time. So Phil, go ahead.
It's not so much a question, just my comment.
Please.
I think the second text was tough, as you said. I had trouble with it, but the Bavka text is pretty straightforward. But I like that he's talking about the birthright being not stolen. And it seems like it's really showing us, Israel, what's important for leaders to be and not to be. And the idea, I feel like it's almost like a little test, like, all right, I'm going to make this stew, and you know, we're going to see what's important to you versus what's important to me. The fact that you just need what's right in front of you, and you can't think big picture. But what I'm concerned for is the land and the people, the generations. You know, he's kind of displaying why he should get the birthright, and then kind of showing us this is how it's going to be if you have a good society. The leaders are going to be smart and measured and wise, and if your leaders are the ones that are just out for the next red stew, it's going to be problematic.
Yeah, I think the thing that the two texts have in common and why they read nicely against each other is that the Bachya text basically says you're buying and you're selling and there's balance, right? And the Nechama text is Esav's crying out, Mordechai's crying out. And so there's kind of a, on one hand, there's a Good is done in the universe and it results in good. Bad kind of occurs in the universe and it results in an echo of bad later on. Like there's this kind of parallelism that's nice between the two texts, which is why my big conclusion, which isn't that big, of course, is to say, like, you know, we hope that things kind of come out in the wash, as they say. So that's the only way I can, but I think you said it really well, which is like, you know, or to finish in a really nice way, lentil stew, everybody. Lentil stew. All right, any last takes? All right, everyone go forth and have a really great week and enjoy and be well.